part of the committee.
Welcome to the Senate Education and General Government Committee. Today is Secretary of State Day.
And yet she's not here.
She's not. We didn't have time for her today. And so if you could pass our apology on next meeting, maybe another meeting. We're going to start with the public hearing on House Bill 2093.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2093 directs the Secretary of State to establish and collect fees from agencies filing rules, requires such fees to be deposited in the State Treasury to the credit of the Secretary of State miscellaneous receipts account, declares an emergency, would take effect upon passage. You have before you a -1 amendment that would permit the Secretary of State to publish required compilation bulletin of rules and orders in print or by placing them on the Internet.
Okay, we have Mary Beth Burkert.
Good afternoon, Chair Hass and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I am the Director of the Secretary of State's Archives Division, and I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 2093. The Archives Division has been responsible for receiving, for filing, compiling, and publishing the monthly Oregon Bulletin and the annual Oregon Administrative Rules compilation since 1993. The division has always charged for subscriptions for the printed versions of both the bulletin and the compilations, and these subscriptions paid for both the production and the publication of the publications. During the 1995-97 legislative session, the legislature enacted ORS 183-365, requiring the additional publication of administrative rules in electronic form and that they be made available electronically free of charge. Since 1997, the Archives Division has published all administrative rules and rule actions on our website monthly and in hard copy, printed the monthly bulletin and the annual compilation. As logic would follow, the demand for hard copy publications has fallen dramatically, and so has the revenue necessary for receiving, for filing, compiling, and publishing the bulletin and the compilation, both electronically and in hard copy. Highs for subscriptions were reached in 1997 for the bulletin, and that was 139 subscriptions, and the annual compilation, which was 56, and then in 1999 for those ordering both the bulletin and the compilation of 144. In 2008, those numbers have fallen to 49 subscriptions for the bulletin, 32 for the annual compilation, and 94 for both hard copy publications. Despite reducing our cost to produce a hard copy publication, we're only printing as many as we have subscriptions for, there are still the costs for receiving, for filing, compiling, and posting to the web the monthly rule actions and the monthly compilation of Oregon administrative rules. Because of the reduction in subscriptions, which funded the majority of the rules program, the Archives Division has had to look at alternatives for funding the rules process. The Archives Division sought a Department of Justice opinion as to whether or not we already had the authority to charge for the production and publication of the administrative rules. The Department of Justice recommended that we clarify the language in 183.355 sub 6, clearly allowing the Archives Division to charge for the production of Oregon administrative rules. Therefore, the Archives Division is seeking a legislative amendment to ORS 183-355 sub 6, allowing us to charge agencies and boards and commissions who use the rules process. We developed the 2009-11 projected budget for the receipt for filing, compilation, and publication of administrative rules, allowing only for rent and 2.04 full-time FTE who perform these tasks. Publication costs for the printed monthly bulletin and the annual rules compilation have been removed from the original formula based on feedback from members of our Ways and Means Subcommittee and the House Rules Committee where this bill originated. Questions were asked about the need for a hard copy monthly bulletin and compilation. We have since determined that we can discontinue the hard copy publication of the monthly bulletin as of January 1, 2010, when the current subscriptions expire. The monthly bulletin will only appear on our website in both HTML and PDF formats starting in January 2010. However, it was also determined that there is still a need and a desire to have a hard copy or printed version of the annual compilation by a number of our users. There's 126 current subscribers, most of which are law libraries, and they have stated that they still need the printed version of the compilation so that law students and other researchers can analyze rule changes over time. Therefore, we will determine the cost for printing and then pass these costs on to these customers using a subscription rate so that only those who want and need the printed publication will pay for the printed publication, and the agencies and boards and commissions will only pay to have the rules compiled, processed, and posted according to statute. Because we will only produce the monthly bulletin electronically, ORS 183-360 needed to be amended to allow publication either electronically or in print, and this was accomplished in the -1 amendments to House Bill 2093. In addition, the Archives Division has formed an advisory committee made up of agency rules coordinators to look at amending our administrative rules to allow for the online publication of tables and appendices used by agencies to illustrate the particulars about their rules, for example, the Revenue Department and their tax tables. These tables and appendices currently are not part of the rules publications and will be an added feature for online users. Finally, the proposed formula used by the Archives Division to develop the rules fee structure takes into consideration how agencies use the rules process. Some agencies file numerous rulemaking actions, but the rules may not occupy many pages in the compilation, while others rarely file rulemaking actions, yet their rules occupy multiple pages in the compilation. Therefore, we developed a two-part formula to make the fee structure most equitable. In surveying our rules customers, most commented and appreciated the balanced approach that we took in developing this proposed fee structure. The charge per rule filing and pages occupied is based on the 2009-2011 projected expenditures for administrative rules divided by the total number of rules filed and the total number of pages occupied. The assessment was based on user activity as of February 1, 2008. And in addition, the cost per agencies were published in the state price list and therefore are accommodated for in the governor's recommended budget. The proposed costs that agencies will be billed are provided to you as part of Exhibit A, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. So you, without this legislation, you wouldn't be able to do the HTML or the internet?
Chairman Hass, that's correct. It costs us, the majority of our costs for administrative rules is the production, the receiving for filing, and then the post, you know, formatting and then posting to the internet.
So you wanted to convert, and then therefore you had to change the way you're paid for doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there's still a cost in compiling and writing. And then it occurs to you that you need to do both, the hard copies and the paperless?
Chair Hass, yes. We still have a request for both, but we have decided to remove the publication cost out and let those who are requesting a hard copy publication pay for those directly through a subscription rate. So agencies will not be billed for something they're not receiving.
Okay. Well, that seems fair. I notice on your, maybe I'm not reading this right, but on your price list,
mm-hmm.
at the bottom, The cost per agency, maybe you can help me here. Cost per agency goes with these changes is much higher. Am I reading that right?
No, okay. I don't think so.
Well, cost per agency looks lower, but then the total administrative rule charges is $392,000. Can you put that in perspective?
The cost per the rules is what we're charging for the personnel and then the rent on the building, what it costs to pay for those things out of the rules budget. So it's the 2.04 FTE.
Okay. So
and then the rent that unit pays towards the building for their space occupied in the archives building.
All right. Well, I guess I'm trying to look at, you know, whether this will ultimately cost more or less. with these changes?
Chair Haas, it should cost less.
It should.
Okay. And especially as we can do more electronically, the printing costs are going to be totally eliminated, and those will be paid directly by subscriptions, as opposed to now, originally how the bill was written, we had figured in the publication costs and the printing costs in the formula, but we've since removed that.
Okay. Further questions of Ms. Herkert?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just curious as to, I mean, because this chart is what you're projecting for the next biennium, correct?
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, yes.
I mean, I'm just wondering how you're assuming, for example, Public Health Division, 845 rural actions. I mean, how do you come up? Is that just historic?
That was based on what they had done up through February 1st, 2008 for that year. So it's over a biennial period. We have to look at the previous biennium to see how many rules they filed in that, and that's what they're being billed for in the future biennium. So we're always going to be billing on what they did the previous biennium. In order to get the price in the price list, we're actually looking back.
This is estimated, and then there will be an actual at some point in time, or this is what you bill.
This is, Senator Cruz, this is what we would bill, and where the difference would be is then the next biennium they would be billed on what they filed in 2009-2011.
Senator Bonavici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I want to make sure I understand this. So currently many of these agencies are not paying at all, correct? Because they're just accessing online.
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, absolutely. Ever since they went online,
right.
Most agencies never even, they no longer subscribe to a hard copy. They're just looking online and taking advantage of the online versions. The only folks who want the hard copy versions are those who have to go back and look at the rule history and what the previous versions of rules did, and because our online versions are only the current version of the rule, they can't do that electronically. And that's something that we'll be looking at as we move forward. But right now, that's the only way that they can trace that.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
So that we're in the column that's number of rule actions, that's staffing, did you say? I'm just trying to understand this chart.
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, rule actions is every time an agency wants to create or change or amend an administrative rule, they have to file what's called a notice of rulemaking action.
Right.
And so every time they file that, that's what we're counting. So some agencies...
Right, but what's the cost for that to you?
How we did that is just divided what it costs us to operate the unit, our actual cost for operating the unit, and divide it by the number of rulemaking actions. And we did percentages so that, because we wanted to make it fair and equitable, because we do recognize that some agencies rarely file a rulemaking action, so to charge on rulemaking actions only was not equitable. And then other agencies may file a lot of rulemaking actions, but their rules occupy very little, take very little effort because they're very small. So we divided percentages to come up with the formula so that you're actually being billed for both. And it's based on what our costs are, our actual costs are for operating the unit. And it's divided either by the rulemaking actions or by the number of pages that their rules occupy.
Did you say or and?
And.
Right. Okay. That's what I thought. Thank you.
There's nowhere in here where you delineate the savings or the potential savings, really.
Chair Haas, not at this time. But we would come back with that.
I think that'd be helpful. Any other questions?
I have another question. Can you please talk about the cost to the agencies compared with what the cost was for their subscriptions that they were paying prior to the time that it was all available online? I'm just trying to figure out if the agencies are going to say, wait, we were only paying, $100 a year to get the subscription, but now we have to pay $10,000 a year.
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, they were only paying, the subscription rate when we were at the height of our subscriptions was about $600 for both the monthly bulletin and the administrative rules, and that paid for two FTE to do it. It did not pay for the building rent that administrative rules has since had to pay after the subscriptions went away. So, or any of the other fees that are associated with rules. They were strictly paying for the printing of the publications.
And, I'm sorry, can I ask one more? And were all the agencies paying the same subscription rate, or did it also vary based on the number of rules that they enacted?
They paid the same subscription rates.
Okay.
Barry Pack.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. I just wanted to add a couple of points from some of the questions from Senator Bonamici and Chair Haas. I think it's important to consider that without this bill and this fee formula, the cost for receiving for filing, compiling, and publishing our administrative rules are supported strictly by the general fund. So this will transfer some portion of that, depending on how agencies pay for this assessment, just like every other assessment that you deal with internally with state government. Some of this will now be supported by other funds. So there will be some general fund savings. It's hard to identify how much that would be, because we don't really know. I think the DAS is still working on better identifying what portion of assessments get paid by general fund, other fund, or federal funds. The other question that was raised or suggested is how are agencies going to respond to this? We did run this not all state agencies, but many of them, particularly the high-volume rules users, particularly ODOT and Revenue and DHS, and there was not a great deal of heartburn. There was a lot of understanding that we needed to come up with a funding formula that would provide this service. As Mary Beth said, they were appreciative that it was an equitable formula, and because it was done in time to be included in not just the governor's recommended budget, but in fact the agency request budget, their understanding that this is sort of part of their base budget and can be accommodated that way, even with some of the tough budget decisions that you all are having to make this session.
Okay. All right. Well, we do not have the proper paperwork here were we even to move this today, so if when we revisit this, you can maybe provide us with something that comes close to quantifying some of that? Would that be within the realm of possibility?
Mr. Chair, we can take a look and see what kind of information. It's a little hard because it's a completely new funding structure from a situation where you had outside users and internal state subscribers paying the cost, not all of the cost, and therefore the general fund was supporting the remainder. It's a bit of an apples to oranges comparison, but we can see what we can come up with to help you understand a little bit better.
Okay.
Do you anticipate... Mr. Chair, do you anticipate that perhaps some of the agencies will be a little less wordy if they're paying by the page?
Sure has, Senator Bonamici. That is our hope, is that, A, they'll make their... But we have a lot of agencies who have rules that are very out of date, and we're based on our previous experiences and other states' experiences is when they went to a fee structure, agencies were very quick to remove their out-of-date rules.
That's probably a good thing.
Okay,
thank you.
Hearing on House Bill 2093. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2085.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2085 modifies the list of documents upon which a notarial officer may rely in identifying a person. We do have a Dash 2 amendment before us that specifies that a fee for a notarial act may not exceed $10, and it permits the public body to collect fees for notarial acts. Although we have there's no fiscal impact statement on the measure, we do not have a fiscal impact statement on the Dash 2 amendment.
You do not have a fiscal impact on the measure?
We do, and there's no fiscal impact, but on the Dash 2s, we do not.
Mr. Threlkeld.
Chair House, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Threlkeld. I'm the director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office. House Bill 2085 is The Secretary's proposed legislation to update the acceptable forms of identification that a notary public may accept when identifying an individual. The main function of a notary is to witness a legal proceeding so that the courts and other interested parties can be certain that the person signing the document, one, knows what is being signed, two, is able to understand the action being taken, and three, is in fact the person whose signature is on the document. Currently under Oregon law, the notary law defines acceptable identification as essentially that which has the person's signature, photograph, and a physical description. There have been recent changes over the last few years in state and federal identification that has caused some forms of ID to no longer meet the requirements under existing Oregon law, even though those IDs may provide greater assurance and security as to the person's identity. A good case in point would be military ID issued by the Department of Defense. When you become a soldier or a serviceman, you go through an extensive vetting process so that the military knows who you are and is able to identify you. Military ID does not meet current Oregon standards because it does not contain a signature or a physical description. So we have a situation today where a good form of ID that we think would be a good form, a notary has to turn that down, so a service member that was home and needed to have a document notarized would have to find some other form of ID instead of being able to rely on that military ID. House Bill 2085 corrects this by updating the acceptable forms of ID that a notary may accept, and we list those to include a current driver's license or ID card that's issued by a state, a current U.S. passport or officially recognized passport of a foreign country, a current U.S. military ID card, a current ID card issued by a federally recognized Indian tribe, and any government ID that contains the person's photo, signature, and physical description. The bill further goes to delete less secure forms of identification, and including those that are issued by a private business or that may only contain the person's signature. Today, I could go to a notary and present my Bi-Mark card that just had my signature, and they could accept that as a form of identification. So the converse of that is we have stronger forms of ID, U.S. passports, military ID that are not acceptable, and we have other forms of ID that are probably pretty easy to forge or create fraudulent documents that they can accept. On the Dash 2 amendments, we identified that currently, based on opinion of our legal counsel, state government cannot charge a fee or accept the fees or collect the fees that our notary employees are able to charge. Our notary employees are in a precarious situation where receiving a government salary, if they were also to collect and retain the fee allowed to be charged as a notary public, they would violate state ethics law. So we're not currently charging for notarizations in our office. We do have a number of individuals that will come and take advantage of this. They'll bring us a stack of 30 or so notarizations, and they'll come to our counter. They'll give them to us. It'll take us an hour or two to notarize those. We'll have to call other people, and other people that want to start a business are left standing in line waiting, we're not able to get paid for providing that service. So that is what the Dash 2 primarily does. It also sets an upper limit of $10 that a notary can charge. It puts that into statute. Currently, the fee that a notary can charge is $5, and it's set by administrative rules. So this would just limit my office's ability to allow notaries to charge $50 for a notarization. But we think that $10 is a reasonable upper limit. So if we decide to change that at some point, that would be the limit that we could do. The fiscal impact that I prepared, there was not a fiscal on the original bill, the Dash 2. We would see a slight increase in revenue, about $9,000 a biennium for our office. It's theoretical that other state agencies could see an increase in revenue as well. I know, in particular, the Department of Corrections. They have to have many of their officers become notaries because they're the only ones with access to the inmates, and when the inmates need documents notarized, they're able to do that, and they're not able to collect any fees or retain any fees from those services either. So with that, the bill did receive 60 yes votes in the House, so if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. I was reading your testimony here, and I saw on your bullet points on the acceptable forms of ID, the last one was a federal, state, county, municipal, or local government issued ID, and it kind of gave me a red flag, and I noticed in the bill that's not included. Did it flip from the bill?
That's not in the bill?
Well, I don't see it.
It's on line page 2, Mr. Chair, lines 4, 5, 6.
Was that already in statute?
Yes.
Chair House.
Yes. So one of these.
That is primarily retained from statute.
Passes muster.
I know on the ID that I have, it has my photograph and my signature, does not have my physical description, so this would not be sufficient. I'm not sure of the legislative ID cards, but it does require those three identifiers.
So a picture of you is not a physical description?
Chair House, Senator Cruz, no. It is a form, but for a notary, like what you see on the driver's license, height, weight, eye color, those sorts of things. So some form of a physical description then adds greater validity to the identification, helps the notary to know that you are really you.
Senator Van Meegen.
Thank you. What are some of the things that require notarization? I think of it as sort of an old-fashioned thing, and see declarations under penalty of perjury as kind of taking the place. But obviously, there must still be a lot of notarization going on. What documents are being notarized?
Chair House, Senator Bonamici, the primary thing is mortgage documents, deeds of trust. Any time that you want to borrow money from a bank or financial institution. Every one of those documents does contain a notarization or a number of notarizations. Notaries can also perform oaths, but the vast majority is really signature validation on some type of a contract. So a lot of times all the parties to the contract aren't in the same place. You might rely on the services of a traveling notary or a title company, and so they want to have some assurance that these documents have gone through a proper process, that the persons identified really are the persons that are signing and are going to be responsible for repaying the contract.
Other questions? No. Okay, well, as you noted, we will need another fiscal report for the amendment.
I will comment, Mr. Chair, though, that it's interesting that potentially my Safeway Club card could be better than my passport.
No,
doesn't seem quite right.
So we're going to have to hold off. Thank you.
Okay.
And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2085 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2086.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2086 permits the Secretary of State to waive the requirement that administratively dissolved corporations apply for reinstatement within 5 years. It declares an emergency and would take effect upon passage. We do have a Dash 1 amendment before us that permits the Secretary of State to waive the requirement that the dissolved corporation apply for reinstatement within 5 years after dissolution if the corporation requests a waiver and shows good cause for failure to apply for reinstatement within the time limit. The measure itself has a minimal fiscal impact, but we do not have a fiscal impact statement on the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay. Mr. Threlkeld.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Peter Threlkeld, Secretary of State, Corporation Division. House Bill 2086, back in 1995, the division requested and the legislature approved House Bill 2219 to limit the time period that a business could request reinstatement after administrative dissolution to 5 years. This was done to prevent abuses that were happening regarding inactive mining and railroad companies that were being reinstated by individuals primarily out of state. They would reinstate the company, they'd rename it, and then they'd sell it to other individuals as an ongoing 100-year-plus Oregon business. It was felt that this practice could mislead consumers. You could have a company that just started last week buy these companies, and for all appearances, they appeared that they had been around since shortly after statehood. One of the unfortunate oversights in that legislation was the inclusion of the nonprofit corporation. Nonprofit corporations cannot be owned by individuals, and consumers are provided no additional protections by limiting the time frame during which a nonprofit can be reinstated. One of the problems with nonprofits is that there's frequent turnover of the officers and the directors, and a lot of times this will happen on an annual basis. Frequently, the addresses registered with the Secretary of State's office do not get updated. Their annual reports are not received by the people that are now responsible. And so a lot of times they will miss making the filing with our office. And in many cases, where you have just brand new volunteers coming into a nonprofit, they're not aware of the legal requirements or the statutory requirements for annual filing. So where this is really starting to become an issue is within the last couple of years, the IRS updated their regulations to now require that almost all nonprofits have to file annual reports. And so a lot of annual nonprofits are now finding that they may have been dissolved 10 or 20 years ago, and they've been acting as an ongoing concern all these years. But now, because of the IRS requirement, they're discovering that somehow they got dissolved some time ago. For a lot of them, this is creating concerns over the legitimacy of donations, any tax-exempt receipts, also ownership of property, and any ability to transfer assets that they may have. House Bill 2086 will resolve this by allowing the Secretary discretion to waive the five-year limit when it makes sense. The original bill had a fiscal impact of about $10,000 in additional revenue, no additional expense on our part, and that doesn't change with the Dash 1 amendments, so we'd still anticipate seeing about the same increase in revenue. What the Dash 1 did, this was a recommendation from our legal counsel. It added clarifying language and added a good cause standard that we would apply when evaluating these requests. The bill received 60 votes, yes votes in the House, and I've already had a number of requests from the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, as well as three other nonprofits who are very interested in taking advantage of these provisions should it become law. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. you said you send out annual notices, correct?
Annual reports, correct.
Or annual reports. So, I've served on nonprofit boards. I understand there's a lot of turnover. But, it seems hard to believe that somebody could, a nonprofit could go for a decade and not realize that they hadn't registered. But
they don't
Senator
exist.
Metzger's
they don't exist.
Laughing. Are there really some examples of years and years that go by and there's no...
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, yes, there are. And a lot of times it's because of that turnover, and you get, whether it's at a parent club association at a school, you know, the people that are there that are running the nonprofit corporation are just parents of school children. And, you know, they maybe just work regular jobs. They don't have a lot of experience, you know, in their traditional corporate world where you're actually an officer or a director and you have those levels of responsibilities. And, you know, I know through my own experience with nonprofits that when you come into a lot of these organizations and there's an annual meeting and a vote's done and people step up and volunteer, and a lot of times you're lucky if they hand off a book. It's like, okay, great. You're our new treasurer. Go do it, you know, and you have to figure out what it is you have to do. So a lot of them don't have a good process for, I would say, for educating those future officers and directors and really getting them up to speed on all the legal aspects of what they're required to do. So they do go a number of years, and I've talked to a number of them. So now, from our part, once you become dissolved, we're not sending you out any more notices. So it's that 1 year that you fail to file, and, you know, for all we know, you're done. So under law, you're able to, as when you're dissolved, you're allowed to do activities to wrap up business. You know, continuing to operate as if you were a regular nonprofit really isn't what you're supposed to be doing, but a lot of them just are unaware, and they're only now becoming aware. So, you know, there are some things that we're able to do. The volunteer firefighters, they actually had a nonprofit since 1959. Sometime in the 80s, they went inactive. They just missed the 5-year deadline. And so they formed a new nonprofit corporation. I have a meeting with their attorney here in a couple of weeks. Most likely, if the bill were to become law, they would reinstate the old corporation and then merge the two so they have good continuity between all of their activities, and then that'll put them back into good legal status and remove any uncertainty over those that gap in years.
And could you comment on the clarification the amendment seeks to achieve?
Chair Hess, in the original bill, there were some language in there that the secretary could, under its own initiative, reinstate a nonprofit corporation, and we really would never exercise that. And so that's taken out. It really just looks at, from the initiative of the nonprofit, they have to make a request. We'll apply a good cause standard, basically, that they were an ongoing concern. If they were a lot of nonprofits will have filings that they'll do with the Department of Justice on an annual basis. We'll just look for some statement or claim that you know, we have been ongoing. The people responsible for updating the information, there was an address change, there was some turnover, and that caused them to not be aware.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. We will close a public hearing on 2086. We do not have a fiscal report on the amendment, which is a hairline above technical in nature, so I have to carry that over, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2087.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2087 prohibits the Secretary of State from charging a fee to file an annual report from a non-profit corporation. The purpose of the corporation is to maintain a historic cemetery. It requires the nonprofit corporation to provide evidence to the Secretary that the cemetery is listed with the Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries. There is a revenue statement and a minimal fiscal impact.
Mr. Threlkill.
The Chair House, members of the committee, Peter Threlkill, Director of the Corporation Division, Secretary of State's Office. Oregon has about 700 historic pioneer cemeteries that are the final resting place of many of Oregon's earliest pioneers and settlers. Most of the 150 historic cemeteries that are formed as a nonprofit corporation are small, non-active cemeteries with few resources or assets that are primarily staffed by volunteers who are committed to helping to preserve and maintain part of Oregon's pioneer history. The $50 annual fee required by statute does create a burden for many of these small cemeteries and forces them to choose between spending resources to maintain the cemetery or paying the state the $50 annual fee. The concept was requested through discussions that we had with the Commission on Historic Cemeteries, and that group was created in statute back in 1999 in ORS 97.782. They're part of the State Parks Department. And the concern was really to address those concerns for the small volunteer nonprofit cemeteries. The Secretary of State believed that this was a very worthy cause and goal that we should undertake during Oregon's 150th anniversary of statehood as a way to honor and help preserve our state's historic and pioneer history. In order to qualify as a historic cemetery, the cemetery must have taken at least one burial prior to February 14th, 1909, so within 50 years of statehood. So we're not really creating any new cemeteries, and for that respect.
It would be remarkable.
It can't explode. Into
So the upper limit really is the about the 700, and as we've had discussions with the commission, a lot of those are owned or deeded to the public community, the county, the township. There's a lot of them that maybe it's just a small few square feet of land somewhere, and that's where some families' ancestors were buried over 100 years ago. We have a very limited fiscal impact. We believe this will reduce our revenues by about $15,000 a biennium, and I would, compare that to the 35 plus million that we collect every biennium. So we did receive 59 votes in the House, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm so tempted to ask about Representative Barnhart, but I won't. So in the revenue statement here, it talks about how there's 700 cemeteries, but only 150 of them are registered as nonprofits. So if the others don't have to be registered as nonprofits, why do those 150 remain registered as nonprofits, which therefore gives them the requirement, unless this bill is passed, to pay the $50?
Chair House, Senator Bonamici, each group of individuals would go through a process to determine why it would be beneficial for them to register as a nonprofit. One of the things I think that really comes to mind is that a nonprofit has perpetual existence. So if my grandfather owned a farm and his great-great-grandparents were buried there or in a corner section, he might choose to divide that and that parcel and have create a nonprofit to own just that specific piece of land so that it could continue to exist and then it would be outside or separate of any land transactions or if he were to sell the rest of the property to someone else. So it would continue to exist, and that's really I think the primary motive for a lot of these groups to form the nonprofit is just that perpetual existence. I would say that a lot of these groups are family members and ancestors, they have some commitment to a couple of weekends a year to go and help maintain and preserve the cemetery and catalog some of the history there.
Okay.
Well, this would be at least the second bill the Senate has passed on
passing out breaks for cemeteries. The Revenue Committee and the Senate passed unanimously a bill to clarify that no property taxes shall ever be paid on cemetery land.
Question.
Senator Metzger?
I'm sure this is correct because I don't see that in the bill, but just for the record, they still have to do their reports, though. They just don't charge the fee.
Chair Haas, Senator Metzger, that is correct.
And then the other one, Mr. Chair, just as a comment, a number of years ago, I might have been the 03 session, could have been 05 session, they all run together now. I had a similar bill from the Secretary of State in my committee, from Secretary Bradbury, and it was to kind of waive fees for all these nonprofits, and it had a huge fiscal on it, which this is not, and I support this. But I know the division gets pressure a lot from, well, you know, we don't make much money either. Why do we have to pay the fee? And they want to jump in then because, oh, it's historic profit, got it now. And we didn't pass that bill, needless to say, but would just kind of urge to kind of keep an eye on the break on that as people start coming in and all wanting to not pay their fees because, you know, we don't generate a lot of money, et cetera. I think this exception is unique because of the nature of it, but I wouldn't want it to expand where every nonprofit, has us do the work without paying the fee.
Slippery slope.
Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2087, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2087.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2087 be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Metzger moves that House Bill 2087 be moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Objection? Seeing none. So ordered. The measure will go to the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Metzger, would you like to...
Oh, I think I have fun. Sure.
Close work session on Senate Bill 2087 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2090.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 29 permits the notary to protest commercial paper under certain circumstances. It prohibits a notary who is a stockholder, director, officer, or employee of a bank, trust company, or other corporation from protesting commercial paper owned or held for collection by the entity. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. Came out of the House unanimously.
Okay. Mr. Thurko.
Chair Haas, members of the committee. Notary protests of commercial paper is a legitimate financial transaction that is allowed in ORS 706 for financial institutions and also ORS 194, notary public law, that allows for the collection of a dishonored check or negotiable instrument. This is really a procedure that has been around for well over 100 years and really dates back to the days when banks cleared all checks, all paper checks, physically. So when you wrote a check to a store, that check, the store would deposit it at their bank, and their bank would send it off to the Federal Reserve, who would then eventually get it back to your bank, and in a month or so, it would wind up in an envelope coming back to your house that showed that it had been paid. Over the last decade, all banks have gone to electronic presentment of checks, so all checks are imaged. Those images are transmitted electronically from bank to bank, and that whole process takes a matter of hours instead of weeks or months, as it did in the past. One of the things that we have is a lessening of the need for a notary's involvement in actually doing a commercial protest. When we talked to the Oregon Bankers Association, they actually couldn't name an instance when any of them remembered having actually had to use this procedure. I worked in a large regional bank for over 10 years, and I had never heard of this when I was at the bank. We never used it. The problem that we're seeing today is that notary protests of commercial paper has been adopted and adapted by so-called sovereign citizen groups to place bogus liens primarily on public officials, corrections officials or judges, sometimes as well as police officers, used to harass and prevent performance of official duties. Increasingly, this is becoming a problem in our state and federal prisons as a way to harass federal judges and prison officials, but also used to harass government tax authorities and other private citizens. We have in the testimony, the attachment is a letter from the U.S. Department of Justice, Federal Bureau of Prisons, Counterterrorism Unit, and citing an example where an Oregon notary has done a commercial protest of commercial paper for a federal prison inmate, and they're trying to make fictitious claims against the judge that's either hearing appeals or heard the original case against the inmate. House Bill 2090 will stop the inappropriate use of by anti-government groups and inmates while still allowing for the legitimate and intended use by banks, attorneys, or investment firms. It's a minor change in statute to restrict the use to only those notaries working for a federal or state financial institution, chartered bank or investment company, or an active Oregon attorney. Our office has long counseled the Oregon notaries that we commission that notary protest of commercial paper is a very archaic procedure, one that requires extensive training and is only appropriately used in specific financial transactions and in that environment. So with Most of the notaries try to steer clear of this, but we do have a few that really like to facilitate some fraud and problems, especially in the prison environment. So this would help us to resolve that problem, help us to work with the courts and the prisons to help lessen some of the harassment that they're seeing. And we do not have a fiscal impact. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
I guess it kind of begs the question that if this is so archaic and if there are more modern, less problematical avenues to achieve the same thing, then why not just outlaw it altogether?
Chair Hass, that was our original suggestion when we did talk to the bankers a number of years ago. We were toying with that very concept, and the pushback that we received was while most local Oregon banks would never imagine that they'd need to do this, they did foresee that some of their international trading departments might need to collect on an overseas check. So they wanted that continued ability. I think this bill really gets at a good compromise solution, allows them to continue to use it as they need it, when they need it, but takes it out of the hands of notaries that would misuse it.
Other questions? Senator Metzger.
Just one question, just to help me understand this a little bit better. Could you just give me a real brief example when you talk about fraudulent activities and how somebody would get money as a result of that? If you could either make one up or whatever, but just walk me through how this is done and what that why that triggers some fraudulent collection.
Okay. Chair Hass, Senator Metzger, the The folks that the adherents of the sovereign citizen movement that really date back to Posse Comitatus, if you're familiar with that group from southern Oregon and northern California back in the 70s, they view that all transactions are commercial transactions, including acts of the government, that this government body is a corporate body. And as a result, all of your acts are corporate or commercial acts.
I understand, but just give me an example.
Okay.
What, you know, I'm the guy, right? What are you going to send me, and what do I do that, you know, that ends up defrauding me? And
So say you sent me a traffic ticket, or you sent me a tax invoice. I'm going to respond to that, and I'm going to give you 57 points that you have to respond to identify what is your legal authority, what is your oath of office, and any number of different arguments. And then when you don't respond, I'm going to accept that your non-response is a affirmative response of my original request. And now we have a contract in my mind. And I'm going to place an arbitrary sum of $200 million on that contract that you now owe me.
But then I say, trash can.
So when you do that, I go to the notary public and I say, well, I sent this to Senator Metzger. He ignored me. So through his failure to act, we have a contract, and I put in the original letter that if you fail to act, that you agreed to these terms. And so now the notary is going to send you a letter and say that a notarized statement, and give you 10 days to respond. And again, you're going to not respond because this is just crazy. And at which point then the notary will issue a notary protest of commercial paper. And from that, they're going to try to do a number of things that through this legitimate collection process. Now, chances are they're never going to get any that $200 million from you. But what they might do is they might waive that debt and report that to the Internal Revenue Service, who's then going to count that as a whole bunch of new income that Senator Metzger has, because waived debt is the same as earned income.
Would they then, do some of them maybe turn them over to a debt collector then, and Harrison that way?
Probably not a debt collector, but they'll try to file a uniform commercial code statement with my office. They'll try to file against any property that you own at the county. So they'll tie up your home or your business or other assets that you have.
But at the end of the day, pardon me, I'm just trying to understand this.
I hope you're not taking notes down. This is not a good idea.
I'm just trying to understand this a little bit better. But at the end of the day, there's no legitimacy there, right? So it's mostly it's either you're harassing me and I just, you know, get tired of it, and or you create a lot of problems for me to unwind to get all this stuff cleared up. So unless I just get mad and say, if I give you $50, will you go away? That might
right.
be the one part. But the other one is just creating a lot of problems for me more than anything else.
That's exactly what it does, is it creates problems for you. And it's designed, when it's used against judges or corrections officials, it's designed to harass and prevent them from carrying out their official duties. So that, you know, that if I make life difficult enough for you, maybe you won't enforce the case against me, or the traffic ticket, or you'll just ignore it and let me have my way. So as you can imagine, this is very popular in prisons.
Okay, and then one just final question, if I could, Mr. Chair, is these notaries, like this one example that we have from Bend, since they are, as you, in your own language, you know, helping to perpetuate this fraud, right? What's the legal liability? Because everybody knows this. You got to know who this notary is, that they're complicit in this. Isn't there some legal recourse against that person, either from, I don't know, from your office or from the Attorney General? Or, I mean, isn't there some either a personal or professional liability that they would have by being a party to that?
That's why we're here with the bill, because under current law, they can perform a notary protest of commercial paper. Now, it doesn't really matter that the underlying document is not commercial paper. It's not a check. It's not a negotiable instrument. So our hands are tied, as we've talked to legal counsel. I would have loved to have revoked the commission of this individual many, many months ago. And this is a problem, a person that we've had repeated problems with on an ongoing basis.
Well, it just seems amazing that you can have somebody with a position, right, and you can't sanction them when even though they're knowingly doing something, when just about everybody can be sanctioned in some way. Okay. And that's fascinating. Well, thanks for enjoying. I understand that better. Thank you.
Great. Now I'll be expecting mail from Senator Metzger.
Pass my bill or else. If you don't pass, I don't get a notice my bill is passed by 3 days. I'll assume it is law.
Mr. Chair, it very well could be that these are the same people who challenge elected officials' ability to serve because they didn't pay in real gold. So kind of the same.
I paid in real gold.
Did you?
William Jennings Bryan all over again.
Okay.
Great.
No further questions. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2090 and open a work session on House Bill 2090.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2090 be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves that House Bill 2090 be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Objection? Seeing none. So ordered. House Bill 2090 goes to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Word over to Senator Bonamici. Would you like to carry this?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if I could get unanimous consent to allow, for purposes of allowing Senator Cruz to vote on House Bill 2087.
Does he have a good excuse, Mr. Chair?
Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Cruz, how do you vote on?
I vote aye.
Cruz votes aye. There is no other action before us. This committee is adjourned.